Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passaran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Dr. Nicola Guerra, who is an adjunct professor at the University of Turku, and is the author of The Italian Far Right from 1945 to the Russia-Ukraine Conflict. Nicola, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. I much appreciate it. And
I guess just to begin with, could you tell us a little bit about how you found yourself focusing on the far right as an academic pursuit? And I mean, I guess, how you found yourself in academia?
Well, I have a particular background because I have been working for, I don't even remember exactly, but almost 20 years in the big pharma industry as a consultant for strategies and patients, doctors, and gatekeepers analysis. So in the linguistic department of market research. And, you know, it's a tough world. And when my daughter born, I was tired to work there, and so I started to reorientate my career, and I decided to discuss my PhD. And at the University of Turku, they gave me the opportunity to do my PhD thesis on a very tough argument, that is the Italian volunteers in the Waffen-SS, that it's a topic that has been longly hidden in Italy, you know, because there were more than 20,000 and there were no academic studies on that. It was like, you know, the rhetoric of good Italians that, you know, they were wrong to stay with the Nazi, but at the end, Italians are good and so on. So it was also challenging, but it was the right time because I had the opportunity to interview 25 members of the Waffen-SS and try to understand the motivations that pushed them to enlist in the Waffen-SS and not in the Italian army or the fascist army. And so my first study, my PhD, is focused on, let's say, far right or extreme right. In that case, I would say the last experience of fascist ideology.
It's quite a shift from market research to interviewing SS members.
Yes, it is. But anyway, not even so huge, because there I was focused on understanding the decision mechanisms, you know, of the consumers, of the gatekeepers, of the ministries of health and so on. And here I'm more focused on understanding the motivations, the dynamics that push people to participate in political radicalism, violence, and sometimes, unfortunately, also terrorism.
Nicola, in the book, a lot of it focuses on the strategies of tension and the years of lead. Perhaps for our Australian audience, could you explain what those were?
Yes, it's quite a tough argument. It's, you know, it's very complicated as a strategy, as a geopolitical tool, and as an ideological development. But by the way, we can summarize these strategies in this way. In Italy was present the biggest communist party of Western Europe. And so you can imagine the consequences during the Cold War. the American intelligence, all the Western intelligence, were really scared that the Communist Party could take a role in the government. And the Communist Party at that time, huge role in local administrations, but not in the government. That was basically managed by the Christian Democrats Party. So really pro-capitalist, pro-American, pro-NATO. So what was necessary, by the way, was necessary to stop the electoral growth of the Communist Party. And obviously there were some instruments that were legal, like pushing electoral propaganda, portraying the Soviet people as Eastern inferior and violent people, such that now we talk about Russia phobia, but it's something that is related to the Cold War. But there were also, let's say, illegal way of doing that. And one of these is the strategies of tension. Basically, the American intelligence from 1947 enrolled the first neo-fascist group, the Fasci di Azione Rivoluzionaria, FAR, in a network that was called Los Angeles Network, was a hidden network. And they were enrolled just to make terrorist actions, false flag terrorist actions, then were attributed to the far left and the anarchist, just to scare the electorate and in that way stop the growth of the Communist Party in Italy. After the FAIR, the Fasci di Azione Rivoluzionaria, this network had a crisis because one of the member, one of the coordinator, us, was a previous intelligent member of the Nazi Germany, but he was also working for the Soviets and he was passing them a lot of information. So they had to restructure this network at the NATO basis in Veneto, and they enrolled other far-right groups like Ordine Nuovo and Avanguardia Nazionale. So basically, it's an operation made of false flag actions to disorientate the electorate and reorientate the electorate toward the pro-Western stances, basically. And there are a lot of declassified investigative information from 10 years, but it's really, really a huge amount of material that needs to be studied in details and also in a very multidisciplinary way, because we need to, it's necessary to focus on the ideological development of the far right and why they made an alliance with the Western intelligences. But there is also to understand the geopolitical role that these terrorist groups had during the Cold War. So very, very interesting and very important, I will say, argument, because now we are in the so-called new Cold War, and understanding the dynamics of the past can also be useful to better interpret the current dynamics.
Nicola, you've made reference to false flag operations. Can you, just for the benefit of the listener, explain exactly what those were?
That, for example, the most notorious and, I will say, mistakenly or often considered the first of these false flag operation is the Strage di Piazza Fontana of the 69, the bomb in the bank. And that generally is referred as the beginning of the strategy of tension. But this is not correct, as I explain in my study, because the strategy really started in 1947 with the Fasci di Azione Rivoluzionaria. Even if the false flag operations were smaller, not a massacre like in the Piazza Fontana bombing. Then there is the Brescia bombing, and also there, a bomb in a square, during a left-wing manifestation with deaths and, you know, and the Secret Service is involved. And in this case, it's a very delicate argument because investigations are still ongoing. And in the next months, there will be updates. And so these are the two main, but then there is also the train bombing campaign that was conducted by Ordine Nuovo and Avanguardia Nazionale, coordinated by this network of American, Italian intelligence, and some information are now available also of an involvement of a part of the German intelligence. And basically, this attack on the train didn't produce any death, but they were scaring people, you know, because they were exploding on train, making people unsafe. And then there is a constant approach, obviously well designed and studied, and the investigators always started to investigate on the far left and the anarchist, even when the proof of the far right involvement was clear. And there are some sentences that condemned general of the Italian intelligence, for example, General Gianadelio Maletti, who wrote a very interesting autobiography, post-mortem, published, where he reconstructs the scope of the strategy of tension, not as something that in Italy there is this strange approach where we say that, you know, they were not the real secret services, they were manipulated secret services, but in reality the secret services were doing their job, let's say, properly, unfortunately, with the direction of stopping the growth, the electoral growth of the far left. And this is very clear now, but, you know, a lot of time has passed and it took really, really a lot of time before achieving the declassification of the investigation that is still partial, and also the declassifications of documents from the secret services.
Nicola, in the book, you outline some of the major ideological divides on the far right or extreme right within Italy, which seem to revolve around an orientation towards Europe or to America, so-called Atlanticism. Can you explain how that's played out during the course of the various generations that have emerged since the end of the Second World War?
Yes, that's what was, let's say, in a certain way, surprising, you know, because general popular media, but also in academic area, we are usual to mismatch and sometimes use synonymously far right and neo-fascism. But in reality, in my book and also in my recent studies on the French far right, for example, what came out is that we need to be very careful under the political science perspective in how we define these groups. Because if we, I know there are many different interpretations of what fascist ideology is, and there is no academic consensus on that. We can identify like three groups, like the liberal theories that, putting it simple, say, okay, if there is extreme nationalism and racism, we are into fascist ideology. Then there is the Marxist interpretation that fascism is a tool of capitalism in period of crisis. And then there is this approach where I really believe it's the more detailed, that is the one of Zev Sternel, an Israeli professor, who says, okay, be careful because fascism is something strange. It's something that comes from the right, but also as a revision of Marxism and reinterpretation, also distortion in a certain way, but it's an ideology different from both Marxism and capitalism. And if we look at history, this is also practically visible because during the Second World War, fascism fought against what they called plutocracies, so basically the Anglo-Americans and the Allies, and also the Soviet communism. So what is strange? It's strange that when the war ended, the groups, the post-war groups, were using a lot of fascist rhetorics, slogans, symbols, images, the cult of Mussolini. They were really using, let's say, tools, propagandistic tools from the fascist era. But in a certain way, they didn't maintain the direction of the fascist regime that was becoming a worldwide ideology against both capitalism and communism. And they made, almost generally, apart from a couple of groups, a definitive choice that is also, that has also important ideological implication. They decided to align with the capitalistic side, with the United States, and also with Israel, because Ordine Nuovo, one of the most notorious terrorist groups in Italy, had strong relationships with the Mossad intelligence, because Ordine Nuovo and many other far-right, but also parliamentary right group like the Movimento Sociale Italiano, sought in Israel the vanguard of the Western world in the Middle East. And so it's really an ideological switch that in a certain way, you know, is very aligned also with the Marxist interpretation, as where fascism is seen as the tool of capitalism. And on the other side, let us understand that we need to be more careful with definitions, because far right and neo and fascism are geopolitically different, as they have different geopolitical scopes and also some differences in their ideological profile. If we think that Mussolini saw the Islam as an allied and the same the Nazi, obviously as a tool to fight the British Empire. Now we are in front of a far right that is Islamophobic and aligned with Western powers. So it's really something that we'll need to investigate further in the future.
Nicola, in the book, you examine the slogans of the far right during the years of Lead. Why was it important to look at these slogans, and how did you go about finding people to talk to about them?
Basically, when I stopped working in business, I thought that, you know, we are in the era of quantitative. We are in the era, that's something I experienced also in business, of big data. We are in the era that we need to measure everything, otherwise it's not real. And we saw this in every area, from climate change, from everywhere. We need always statistical significance. We need always big data available. But from my academic experience and business experiences, I believe that sometimes we are in a hurry. We want to measure, but we don't know exactly what are the variables that are relevant to be measured. And so I thought about political radicalism and the far right. Stop just a moment, because we are losing, with the time passing, we are losing a lot of information. So we are losing all the oral sources. What did they say at the time? Because it's different to write a political program or to write, you know, revendicate an action with a written communique. And it's different what the great corp, the masses, the people of the far right was singing or shouting in the square. So first of all, I tried to check online if there were video of the period, and they were very, very poor. And then at that point, I decided to open a Facebook group on the Years of Lead that now has more than 10,000 members between previous extremists, current extremists, obviously intelligence, obviously academics. So it's a huge group where I ask people that was active in the period to share the slogans they were singing in the squares. They did it. And then I validated these slogans with a panel made of far left and far right previous extremists, because some of them are now not anymore involved in political extremism. And at that point, I had a good list of these slogans, and I tried to do what is can be considered a segmentation, let's say a cluster analysis, to identify what were at that time the key themes, the key pillars of the public expression of the far right. Not the hidden documents, not the programs of the groups that were sometimes not available, but collectively how this far right was acting. And what came out, it was how determinant in the slogans were this invocation for authoritarian regime, like the Pinochet regime in Chile, or the Greek dictatorship. And also these confirm our large size of the far right of that time was supporting authoritarian Western shift in Italy to block the left and the far left. So basically, the, let's say, oral sources and the classified sources are concordant in this logical switch. Obviously, there were groups that they were not aligned at all with this, like a small group, Jeune Europe, founded by Jean Thiriat and active during all the 60s. But they started in what we can say, we can define far right, but then they moved to something like Euro-Sovietism. They idealized Stalin and Mao Zedong. And so they moved from the far right to the, let's say, extreme left. One of the members of this group initially was Renato Curcio, who then became one of the leaders of the Red Brigades. So also here, it's not rare to read that Jeune Europe is a far-right movement, but in reality, it's a mass movement, let's say. It's a movement with a very strange ideological development, with ties with the Chinese intelligence and the Romanian leadership, with the Black Panthers in the US. So I would be very, very careful to consider this group far right. They started like a similar to far right group, but they moved to anti-Americanism, third worldism. So this is the only group that in reality opposed to Western policies, NATO, starting from the far right. All the others were basically aligned with the ideological choice of supporting the Western world against USSR and let's say less at that time, but also China.
It's all very complicated. Not much simpler is the conflict in Ukraine. Could you speak a little bit about how the far right in Italy have responded to that conflict and how it sort of has split things?
That's, let's say, a drama for the far right. You know, far right is always portrayed like, you know, this black threat to democracy, if democracy is something we still have. And it's, you know, it's we tend to see that when you have a threat in front of you, you tend to uniformize everything and see everything similar. But in reality, what happened with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also before with the so-called Donbas war, was a very hard and split in the Italian far right. What happened basically? A part of the far right, the most active part, that is Casa Pound Italia, aligned clearly with the pro-Western stances. In their journal, in their social media activity, they go on describing Russia as inferior people and that there is a double invasion of Europe as part of the West. One invasion from East, from Russian inferior and violent people, and one invasion from Africa. And they put them together. So they adhere to this Western supremacies, very similar to the American far right and movement we see in America. But on the other side, there were also movement that from the far right took an Eurasian stance. I mean, I won't say there is a part that is pro-Putin, you know, this is typical of the far right. They like the leader, oh, they like the personality, oh, this is strong, this is my leader. But mainly in this case, it's a geopolitical choice. They see Europe under the NATO occupation. They are anti-capitalistic as the first, the roots of the first fascism, betrayed by fascism itself, by the way. And so they are pro-Russian, but I will say pro-Eurasian, because a good part of them also support China. Obviously, the majority is pro-Western, but I would not, you know, I will take care to this Eurasian minority, because, you know, if in the past during the Cold War was very easy to, let's say, mobilitate the far right against communism, because all the far right groups were basically against communism, and so it was possible to build a bridge between Western intelligence, official Western intelligence, but also hidden Western intelligence like the Agincourt Press and these groups. Now, in the new Cold War, the far right is split. So we have some pro-Western and a minority, anyway, culturally very active, that defines itself Eurasianist or multipolarist. And so it's a very relevant split under the ideological, geopolitical, and also for the conflict, because currently at the front we have far-right militants shooting each other. A part enlisted in the Ukrainian Foreign Legion under the coordination of NATO and the Ukrainian state, and another part in the pro-Russian militias of the Donbas, obviously under the coordination of Russia and Russian army. And this is quite relevant and quite interesting, because online there is a lot of hate speech of one far right against the other, and there are a lot of tensions that sometimes appear also in the street and during the manifestations. There are clashes between the leaders, the ideological leaders, because from one side we have previous Terza Posizione leader like Gabriella D'Inolfi, who is supporting the pro-Western stance, while on the other side we have another leader of the far right of the 70s, Maurizio Morelli, who is supporting really a pro-Russian, a pro-Eurasian stance. And this conflict ideologically goes on also in their magazines, in their social media. So it's not something we could say tactic or something it's really deep fracture in the horizon. And among the Orangeanists, there is also a fraction, because there are the pro-Alexander Duginists, and there are those who, on the contrary, believes that Dugin is betraying Orangeanism, he's not a real Orangeanist, and he is like, let's say, a slave of Donald Trump. So the conflict really created ideological conflicts inside the far right.
Nicola, the Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, had a youthful flirtation or participation in the MSI and related groups. How do you explain her rise, and how would you situate a figure like Meloni, and I suppose the right in Parliament, in terms of the history of Italian fascism? Hmm.
Yes, I talked and interviewed Giorgia Meloni many years ago, before her party had this big electoral growth, even if, you know, it was a switch of electors from the Lega Nord to Fratelli d'Italia, basically, because that would happen exactly. So there was this movement of electors from the Lega Nord to Fratelli d'Italia. And Giorgia Meloni, I think, is very coherent with the history of the parliamentary far right, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, born in 1948, that then became, with Gianfranco Fini, who declared fascism as the absolute evil, Alleanza Nazionale, and then developed in Fratelli d'Italia. These far-right parliamentary parties have been always pro-Western, pro-Israel, pro-Western world. And when Nixon visited Italy, it's a famous, there was a famous slogan where they tried to you know, say, Nixon, be careful, because the Christian Democrats are talking with the communists and are betraying anti-communists. So I think she is really aligned with this conservative electorate that is dominant in Italy. It's really, we saw that with Berlusconi, we saw, there is a, like this part of the Italian electorate that is through decades really conservative. And she was capable to keep the Western orientation of the Movimento Sociale and Alleanza Nazionale. And obviously, this is politically and ideologically coherent. She was less coherent in her books, because in the first books she wrote, she was mentioning Vladimir Putin as a model of the Christian Europe. That's obviously quite absurd if we think how many religions there are currently in the Russian Empire, and that there are leaders of the current Russian Federation that are Muslim. So, and that Moscow is the European city with the highest number of mosques and places of cult for Islam. But that what she wrote, that Putin was, you know, like a model for this Christian Europe. And now, obviously, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, she switched position. She is very pro-Ukrainians. She is very in good relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky, and so she has a clear stance. And if in the propaganda she had some different positions, you know, for the electorate to get votes, basically, ideologically she is very coherent with the Movimento Sociale and the Alleanza Nazionale parties. And obviously, there are some members of her party that sometimes contradict her, but she has in the lead. She has the party under control, and the political and geopolitical line of Fratelli d'Italia is is quite clear.
Nicola, you recently also published an article, The Dark Green Agenda, Tracing Eco-Fascist Ideologies and Identity in Italy.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about how things like the climate crisis conceived of by groups like Casa Pound and La Foresta Sciavanza, and what you found about how they see environmentalism?
Yeah, you know, the environmental question is like, it's very similar to the Ukrainian-Russian war. Usually we think about environmentalism as something left-wing. But in reality, in Italy especially, since the 60s and 70s, there was this key figure whose name is Rutilio Sermonti, who is an eclectic person. I interviewed him a couple of times because he was a member of the Waffen-SS during the Second World War and then in the Nazi Polizei. Very educated, a family of very educated brothers. And he wrote a lot of books about environmentalism as organicism. I mean, the idea of this environmental far right is that the human laws cannot violate the laws of nature that are superior because they are part of the creation, you know, and they are the rules we need to follow. This is something that's ongoing in the Italian far right from, let's say, the 60s, 70s, and so it's a huge debate going on. There were many associations like Fare Verde, Make It Green, or another couple of associations very active. And so, not surprising, but there is also in this case with the climate change question, in the far right, there are also a lot of negationists, and there are a lot of people who, you know, believes it's not true, that it's something to manipulate the masses, that in reality climate change doesn't exist, that it's only a way to sell electric cars and blah, blah, blah. So there are two groups, very, very different one from the other, always clashing. And this is something also we need to go into details in the future. While in the past, this environmental far right was linked only to Italian thinkers like Rutilio Sermonti and other ecologists. Now its international profile is growing because this person usually mentioned Ted Kaczynski, Unabomber, and sometimes they also mention Pentilincola. And so we have two different environmental far right. One who claim for an authoritarian state who must respect the organicism of nature and impose these rules to people. And then there is another fraction of the ecologist far right who is against central states and is against national states and is dreaming some micro communities that self-administers themselves following the law of nature. So basically we have three groups. Those that are against any environmentalism because they believe it's bullshit, it's like not true, it's a way to stop progress, it's a way that the far left, the left is using, you know, for manipulating people. Then there are the ecologists far right that are divided in two subgroups. The first one wants an authoritarian centralized state that imposes on people the law of nature. And the other is against the national states and want micro communities across Europe. So it's a really complex question. What is relevant is the third group I mentioned, those that are against the national state, because in their slogans, in their plans, they design strategy for destroying the national state. Obviously, they are not big groups, but anyway, theoretically, they design how to destroy the national state. So this is quite interesting, I would say.
It's certainly keeping things interesting. Andy, do you have perhaps the final question?
I do. It might sound a little bit silly, but I would like to know your opinion, Nicola. In the book on the far right since 1945, you make reference to J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings, and something called Hobbit Camps, which I think has also emerged in some of the public discussions around Giorgio Meloni. Can you just explain why on earth Hobbit Camps are present in the Italian far right, please?
That's something it's still ongoing, by the way. There are a lot of, you know, small groups also at local level because, you know, the studies on the Italian far right have been focusing for so long on these organizations involved in terrorism or the strategy of tension, like Ordine Nuovo, Vanguardia Nazionale, and so on. But there are also studies that we need to conduct on smaller realities at local level, and that till nowadays they use Tolkien as a master or the figures of his novels as symbols of heroism, ecologism, traditionalism, and also far-right feminism. But when this started, basically, it started when the Movimento Sociale Italiano made it clear that it's Western hands, the decision of supporting NATO, the decision of staying on the Western side against the Soviet Union and so on. And the youth movement, the Fronte della Gioventù, was split in two different currents, those who followed the party and those who were against the party. And the leader of this part against the Movimento Sociale Italiano was Marco Tarchi, that is also a professor of political science now and one of the more informed, obviously, analysts of the far right. And he basically organized this Campiobit because that's what he wrote and what he usually says when you interview him. And he did it on purpose because he said there were so many young militants that were tired of talking about what was fascism, what was Mussolini, and these arguments didn't have any appeal anymore on the youth that was listening rock music. Also in the far right, they started to have these long hairs. And so he felt that there was a space for a new way to approach being of far right. And Tolkien was identified because all the young far-right militants were reading Tolkien or Julius Evola. There are those who hate Julius Evola and love Tolkien and vice versa. And what they found at that time in Tolkien was the heroism, because they felt they were under siege from the far left and the state, so this far-right victimization was really aligned with the figures of the heroes in Tolkien novels. They were ecologists through the teaching of Rutilio Sermonti, the organization Fare Verde. So they found something interesting in The Lord of the Ring, but also in The Hobbit and also in The Silmarillion. And so basically we can say that Tolkien novels in Italy were at the center of this switch of the far right. And also there was this magazine called Eowyn, from the heroine, female heroine of The Lord of the Rings, that started to develop, let's say, far-right feminism. And during this development of this far-right feminism, they had also contact with Marxist feminists. And I found and I published an article where I explained that they were, these far-right women were interviewed by Noidone, a far-left communist, traditional communist, I would say, Marxist magazine, that were surprised how they dressed like the others, people like far-left women. And so it was a kind of generational switch. And let's say Tolkien was, I won't say the inspirator, obviously, but was the tool that made it possible. And still nowadays, if you talk or interview any militant or any sympathizer of the far right, they always mention Tolkien as a reference point. And when you try to push it, let's say, saying, okay, but Tolkien doesn't have anything by way of the fascist ideology, or they don't care. What they care is ecology, heroism, and traditionalism. And they see these in Tolkien. And if you try to push them back and say, okay, traditionalism, I don't know, maybe conservatism or maybe something different, it's like a milestone now. And still nowadays, also, if you talk with militant, young militant of Fratelli d'Italia, they read Tolkien. And if you talk with militant of Casa Pound, Tolkien again. And if you talk with the pro-Russian far-right, Tolkien again. So it's like something that I think also made the youth of the far right visible, because before the Campi Hobbit, the youth of the far right was not considered at all. The Movimento Sociale Italiano didn't consider young people as a resource, and also female people in the Movimento Sociale Italiano didn't count anything. They were able only to talk about how a woman must live at home, or if the women stuffs, let's say. So with the Campi Hobbit, this changed. The youth entered more directly in the political and ideological scene. Women joined the political scene from the far right. And so I think also today they keep this Tolkien like a totem, like a cultural reference of a cultural revolution that, let's say, anyway, it's not anymore on place, because what is now doing Fratelli d'Italia is moving towards a Western conservatism aligned with Trumpism. So it's very difficult to find points of connection with the novels of Tolkien, with the elves, or with the rivers, the forests, but it's still a cultural reference nowadays.
Well, Nicola, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us. The book is The Italian Far Right, from 1945 to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Nicola Guerra, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity of sharing some information, some point of views on this difficult political area to be investigated.
Indeed. Well, Andy, that is our program. We'll be back next week. See you later.
See you then.
Questions, questions, questions flooding into the mind of the concerned young person today.
It's nearly Science Week again, so you better be getting your teams ready for the annual Lost in Science Trivia for 2025.
Yes, Monday the 11th of August, starting at 6 at the Birmingham Hotel in Fitzroy, Melbourne.
All the details on the 3CR website or on the Lost in Science Facebook page.
And if you want to register for a table, email us at lostinsci@gmail.com.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.